lots of seeds from all around the world and just planting them out to see what would survive.
Right, and surprised, just briefly, surprised by how successful it's been?
Yeah, very surprised, because there was absolutely no... Well, as we said, you know, the fact that we could barely keep a houseplant going is the biggest shock of all, really. but I think with a bit of tenacity, yes, keeping on going, it proves that almost anything is possible.
Right. Well, I suppose it's inevitable at this point to say, well, first of all, thank you, Joe Harper, for joining us. But I now am thirsty, team, for a cup of tea at some point after today's show. That's all we have time for, I'm afraid, on The Times at One. I will be back tomorrow at the same time. Thanks to my producer, Hugo Chambray, and Ryan Boyden, who is the technical operator. Next on Times Radio, I've been joined by the lovely Richard Coles. What's on the show?
Good afternoon. Well, we're listening to... I'm sitting in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, 800 cases of shoplifting per day. Am I in the wrong bit?
No. No, I was trying to say no briefly because I think we're just running out of the jingle coming up. Here it comes.
Shoplifting and tennis.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Richard Coles sitting in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, 800 cases of shoplifting per day are going unsolved. How on earth do we get to grips with it? And should the public step in? We'll catch up with the action from New York, where Emma Raducanu has won her first round match in the US Open. As the summer comes to an end, where's the best place to get yourself a last-minute holiday deal? The Times travel team will give us their top tips. And after three, I'll be joined by Fergus Butler-Galley to chat about his new book, 12 Churches. But first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Israel says it will investigate claims from Gaza's health ministry that at least 20 people, including journalists, were killed in strikes on a hospital in the south of the enclave. The Israeli military says it regrets any harm caused and insists it doesn't target reporters. Al Jazeera, Reuters and Associated Press have reported the deaths after the IDF hit the Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis. Israel's security cabinet is expected to discuss a ceasefire deal with which Hamas has already accepted tomorrow. Tal Schneider from the Times of Israel says Netanyahu is facing mounting pressure from a number of angles.
This government is influenced heavily by very extreme ministers. The two ministers that are from the extreme right wing, they keep making threats that they will step out of the government if the government will decide on a ceasefire. So if Netanyahu, if the prime minister wants to go into a ceasefire, he has a majority, but he knows that this is the end of this political government.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing pressure to take a more radical approach to the small boats crisis, as a YouGov survey for The Times shows 7 out of 10 people believe he's handling the issue of asylum hotels badly. That number includes over half of Labour voters. In a bid to address concerns, Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, announced plans this weekend to overhaul the asylum appeal system to deport asylum seekers faster. Political correspondent Terry Stiasny says time will tell if those plans are enough.
If this is successful, if people are going through the system more quickly, if the system seemed to be more efficient, then I guess that maybe people will recognise that something has happened there. But yes, the moves have been quite slow. Yvette Cooper has been saying that what she wants to see is fewer appeals. But of course, you know, you've got to remember that this government as well is dealing with a huge backlog of asylum claims. And at the moment, unless the system is changed, that processing, those legal processes do take a while to go through the system.
One person's been airlifted to hospital after a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight. Emergency services were called to the incident near Shanklin Road this morning. Witnesses say they saw the helicopter spiralling before it went out of sight and came down in a hedge. Campaigners are warning a promise to tackle violence against women and girls can only be fulfilled if it addresses child sexual abuse. Organisations, including the NSPCC and Barnardo's, have written to the government expressing concern over its upcoming strategy. The Conservative unions are calling for on-the-spot fines for people who play loud music on public transport. Railway bylaws already prohibit playing music if someone else finds it annoying. The Conservatives want similar protections for bus passengers. Shadow Transport Secretary Richard Holden has told Times Radio immediate action would be better than a longer legal process.
At the moment, you've got to go through a court case. I don't think we should have to do that. I think swift justice is what's required. The idea of giving somebody a ticket and saying they're going to turn up to court in a few months' time, I just don't think is going to cut the mustard when it comes to enforcement anymore. That's why we're putting these comprehensive proposals forwards today.
Applications to UK agricultural colleges are up, driven by the popularity of the television show Clarkson's Farm. The Royal Agricultural University saw an 11% rise in rural land management courses and an 18% boost in farm placement programmes. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
A very good afternoon. I'm Richard Cole, sitting in for Fee and Jane, literally where the sun doesn't shine on perhaps the last fine day of the year. Hey-ho. Coming up, we'll be talking the tennis as Emma Raducanu cruelly raises hopes at the US Open. We'll be asking if the public should get involved in discouraging shoplifters in this golden age of shoplifting. We hear from Gaza, where a strike by Israel has killed 20, among them journalists, according to sources there. We'll be hearing about rising levels of abuse reported by MPs as the migration debate intensifies. Last-minute holidays, we'll discover your best chance of a high-value, low-disappointment break. Working from home has proved disappointing to many Gen Zs who apparently are dying to get to the office. We'll ask why. Student finance is our topic on Money Matters. We'll be looking at summer reading with books person Laura Hackett, and I'll be talking church shop, with the Reverend Fergus Butler Galley, whose new book discusses a dozen churches from Bethlehem to Massachusetts, which he considers significant in the story of history and the story of Christianity. No, Lincoln Cathedral. What's that about? Now, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. Number three is Strictly Come Dancing star arrested on suspicion of rape. The second most read story is Routine Eye Surgery Leaves Woman 29 Blind. I Want My Life Back. And the most read piece on the Times website is Angela Rayner's Allies Defend Hypocritical Purchase of Second Home. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you're already a digital subscriber to The Times and Sunday Times, you've access to a whole range of newsletters, including the politics newsletter. It's delivered straight to your inbox every weekday morning. To sign up, just log into your Times account and head to My Newsletters. Now, new figures suggest hundreds of shoplifting cases are going unsolved every day in England and Wales. According to the Liberal Democrats, 290,000 cases were closed without a suspect last year, which is more than half of all reported incidents. The party is calling for police commissioners to be scrapped and for the money to go to frontline officers. Lib Dem MP Joshua Reynolds spoke to Rosie Wright and Alexis Conran on Times Radio Breakfast.
We've seen suggestions by Conservative police chiefs that it's up to the public to try and stop shoplifters. I've worked in retail. I know how dangerous and frightening it can be to confront shoplifters when you don't know what they're going to do next. Are they going to be aggressive? Are they going to be abusive? Do they have a knife on them? And so it should be for the role for police to be protecting us. And senior police chiefs shouldn't be passing the buck when it comes to this.
I'm joined now by the Chair of International Chamber of Commerce UK, Lord Billimoria. What impact is this having on retailers and local communities?
This is a situation where, when it comes to business, you rely on a safe environment, particularly as a retailer, particularly as a small business. And a government, the number one priority of any government has to be the security of their citizens. And of course, that involves defence of the realm in terms of our armed forces. But it also means citizens feeling safe and secure on a day-to-day basis, whether you're in your home and you're worried about being burgled, or your car, or whether you're going to a shop, or whether you have faith that people who commit crimes are going to be caught, going to be charged, and going to serve whatever the punishment is. What is happening at the moment on the prevention side? We've fallen so far behind. If you think about it, police stations have been closed literally year after year. The neighborhood police officers, if you remember, on their bikes in your neighborhood. You would see them. They knew who you were. You knew who they were. You had their phone numbers. They were a deterrent. They carried intelligence and they were there. They don't exist anymore. You never see them. So what we need, I believe, over here is we need a complete change in our approach to policing. I was crying out for years that we needed more police officers, 20,000 more. Well, that has been happening, but we need to go further. I think we need to go down the route of Commissioner Bill Bratton in New York in the 1990s when he had the broken window strategy, where he said, we're going to come down really hard on small crimes, what are perceived to be small crimes, because then that will prevent the more serious crimes of the extreme of murders from happening. And his strategy worked really, really well. So you cannot have a situation here where you've got over 500,000 shoplifting offences that are reported, and yet only a tiny, literally 800 a day, almost 300,000 a year are going without anyone being...
We're losing you there, Lord Fittimore.
The best area... Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, you're back. I just wanted to...
Yes.
Do you think it's not just a question of intensifying police concentration on those offences? Do you think also that they should be better resourced with tougher penalties for those who offend?
Well, for a start, why is there an extreme between Norfolk, that has almost 30%, and London, which has less than 1 in 16 of the crimes committed are actually charged, assault? Why is there this extreme in one small country? That is what I don't understand. So it is possible.
So we'd like a sort of...
Yes.
OK, we're going to just get Lord Bullimoria back on the phone. The disparity in those cases is quite striking, because you can see that the Met Police in particular have done particularly badly on this one. The data covers police forces in England and Wales, except for Humberside, but also includes the British Transport Police. And the Met have the worst record, with 76.9% of its 93,000 shoplifting cases being closed with nobody identified as a suspect, and just 5.9%, 6% of shoplifting incidents recorded in the capital and the wider region resulted in a charge. And it certainly seems to be lots of people's daily impression that there's almost a kind of casual approach and a kind of acceptance that shoplifting is just simply part of everyone's everyday experience. Lord Bullimore, thank you for rejoining us on the phone. Yeah. You've been talking about the cost of the social contract of letting this one slide, as it were. What about the impact on UK businesses?
Yes, I mean, the cost is huge. It's £2 billion alone is the cost. But it's much more than that. Is why is there a disparity in the country when you have one area, Norfolk, that is solving 30%, and the Metropolitan Police in London, it's 1 in 16. So this, the police, then when I talk to the police about this, they say, we don't have the resources, we have to prioritise, we're understaffed, we're underfunded. But I mean, there is no excuse for this. The government has to sort it out. We have to provide whatever funds are required, because this is a real priority. You cannot have people feeling unsafe and shoplifters just getting away with it. That's what's happening at the moment. And then they're not being punished enough. So you've got to have the prevention, but you've also got to have the punishment and the deterrence. And I know shopkeeper after shopkeeper who they're putting in their own defenses as much as they can with their CCTV, but it's dangerous to confront somebody. These shoplifters, they may have a knife, and that is the responsibility of the police. There was some police commissioner who said, oh, the public should be taking this into their own hands. Are we going to let loose a whole vigilante system over here? That is not how this country operates. We have policing by consent. We have a police force historically that has been respected around the world. The whole image of a London bobby is the best policing in the world. We need to get back to that.
Would you like to see government support for retailers who are having to deal with the consequence of this? I mean, not just the cost of their business, but also the kind of threat posed to staff who are having to sort of become, in a way, untrained enforcers of the law.
Well, retailers are beginning to form their own organisations, trying to increase their security by clubbing together. The big retailers, of course, have the resources to do it by employing security guards. But the small retailers, they can't do that. They can't afford it. But they shouldn't really have to do that. We shouldn't have, at the moment, another link to this. Time after time, I hear around the world, Britain is unsafe. People are having their mobile phones snatched on the streets. Oh, you can't wear a smart watch. I've got personal experience of friends who've come across from India, said, can I wear my watch on the streets? I've heard it, I'll be attacked and mugged and it'll be taken from me. People have started, this is not the image that the United Kingdom as a country should have. You always felt safe walking on our streets. And that's where we need to get back to.
I mean, it's important to remember, isn't it, that the overall crime statistics show quite a stunning decline, actually, in the numbers of reported crimes. It's just one or two crimes, isn't it, where it's been particularly acute. The rise in shoplifting is perhaps the one where it's been steepest. It does affect perception, yes, though.
It does. The perception absolutely is very, very important. And, of course, knife crime, there's no running away from that. Knife crime has been a serious issue over here, and we are trying to clamp down on it. And, again, I'm not blaming the police because, quite frankly, they feel they've been under-resourced. They've had to close down police stations, cut out, in fact, neighbourhood policing. So the government to step in and say, we're going to back you, and the priority is the security of our citizens. People have got to feel safe, and this perception around the world has got to go back to where it used to be, where we had the perception of having the best police force in the world.
Just heard from a former police officer, Chris Simpson, his WhatsApp, to say the key issue with policing is that they just can't recruit the numbers required. It's just not an attractive career anymore. And he comments as someone who served for 25 years.
Well, it should be a profession that someone is proud to join. My great-grandfather in India was in the police. He was a superintendent. He was awarded the title of Khan Bahadur. My great-uncle was the first commissioner of police of Bombay after India's independence. So I come from a family of police officers, and we're very proud of that background. And it was a profession that you were proud to join and do very well at.
You alluded a minute ago to recent calls from some quarters, I think a police and crime commissioner, suggesting that the public might like to become a bit more activist in reaction to this and perhaps take some action themselves against shoplifters. That would leave many people feeling uneasy, and I guess you would be among them.
I would say that what the public need to do is to report it when they see it. And that has to happen, and that isn't always happening. But the idea of asking the public to actually intervene and confront a shoplifter is very dangerous. And many of them could be carrying knives. And you cannot put members of the public in that position. As I said, are you trying to create vigilantes? Is that is not the way we've operated in this country, and we never should go down that route. That is the police's responsibility to keep us safe.
Do you think we're also perhaps left less defended with a policy to do away with the shorter prison sentences that were once a sentencing option for judges, that without that stick rather than carrot, if I can put it that way, again, that creates circumstances which are not going to be conducive to getting a grip of this?
As I said earlier on, it is not only about prevention, you've also got to have the deterrent, so that if you commit a crime and if there is a zero tolerance, and you are punished severely for shoplifting, for burglary, for car crime, then that should act as a deterrent. And sadly, it is always a small number of individuals who are multiple reoffenders. And that's something that we've got to continually address in generally speaking when it comes to crime.
It's not really a sort of challenge to detective work, is it? Because very often these people, as you say, are frequent flyers, if I could put it that way, identities known and addresses known to the authorities. And yet, again, no sort of meaningful intervention seems to get made. Again, that undermines, doesn't it, public confidence that we are protected from people who break the law in this way.
If the public have the confidence that people who commit crimes are going to be caught, are going to be charged, are going to be punished, and punished appropriately, that is where we've got to get to. And it'll never be perfect. It never has been historically, never will be. But you can do your best. And the Bill Bratton experiment worked in New York. Yes, there were a few criticisms, but it actually worked with that broken window strategy. It brought down not only all crime, but it also brought down the very serious crime. And that's the whole, because a lot of these smaller crimes can lead criminals to do worse things. And this is very important that we nip it in the bud and are strict from the smallest of crimes. And shoplifting has become a serious crime, now 500,000 a year. I mean, it has got out of control.
Lord Billimoria, Chair of International Chamber of Commerce UK, thank you very much for joining us. And Frank has WhatsApp to say there's a dichotomy here. Crime is falling, yet the police complain of not having enough resources. Well, that's a whole new question. Right, at least 20 people, including four journalists, have been killed in an Israeli strike on a hospital in southern Gaza. The dead include staff from Reuters, AP and Al Jazeera. Israel says it's opened an investigation. Samer Al-Atrush, the Times Middle East correspondent, joins me now. Samer, what more do we know about the circumstances of this strike?
Well, so far from what we gather, the journalists, there were several strikes, according to eyewitnesses. It wasn't just one strike. And it seems that, again, this is preliminary, but it seems that the first strike killed some of the journalists and others were killed, along with a member of the civil defense, an emergency worker, when they came on the scene. We did see the footage of, one of the strikes, the second or the third, which shows the civil defense workers going into the building in this medical complex, and then an airstrike in their vicinity. Now, whether it was targeting them or just something next to them, we're not quite sure. The Israeli military says that they are investigating and that they regret any loss to life or harm to civilians. Obviously, now we've reached almost 200 Palestinian journalists who've been killed in the past 2 years. At times, Israel has acknowledged that they deliberately targeted some of them, saying that they were members of Hamas or the Islamic Jihad, something that's been disputed in some cases by their employers. So that's what we know for now. Again, it's there are no foreign journalists who've been allowed into Gaza except on brief embeds with the Israeli military. So it is kind of it's a bit difficult for news agencies and international media to. Well, it's impossible for them to get their staff in. And many of them have been relying on these local Palestinian journalists.
Do we know if the hospital, the Nasser Hospital, I think, has there been any allegation that it was used for anything other than medical purposes?
Well, there have been allegations in the past. We've seen that in Shifa, we've seen that in Nasser, we've seen that in other hospitals. Specifically on today's strike, the IDF did acknowledge that they conducted a strike and that they have ordered an investigation into the casualties. We still don't know why they conducted the strike.
Any suggestions also that the second strike suggests that was deliberate, targeting people coming in response to the first strike?
Well, it would appear that way, but we really don't know what happened there. We don't know if it was an errant missile. We've seen that happening before. We don't know whether they misidentified the emergency workers coming in. We have seen emergency workers deliberately killed in Gaza in one incident a couple of months ago, in which they were responding to injuries and they were intercepted and ambushed and shot dead. Now, the person who was responsible for that in the Israeli military, the commanding officer, I think he was let go. Obviously, the UN and others and the International Red Cross had made a big fuss about it. What happened today, we're still not quite sure why there was a second and possibly a third strike. It's not clear why that would have happened, whether it was deliberate, whether it was an accident. It is unusual to see that, I have to say. The incident that I referred to, that happened under the cover of dark. It was a small arms fire. It was Israeli soldiers who did the shooting. But to see multiple air strikes or tank shells, we're still not quite sure what type of strike, but it's likely an air strike. Multiple air strikes, including targeting civil defense workers, that's not something that we've seen very often.
Are you able to tell us anything about the latest that's happening at the hospital and the surrounding area?
I'm sorry?
Are you able to tell us anything about what's happening now, the situation presently in the hospital and the surrounding area?
Currently, I think people are being very, very wary of any further strikes. So this is, this is in Khan Yunis, and, there was a major operation there, and it's, much of Khan Yunis has been destroyed. It's close to the very southernmost border of the Gaza Strip. But there's also a lot of refugees. There are people who've come in from other parts of Gaza that have been destroyed. So it's a pretty chaotic situation, at the moment. And I think people are just very, very scared. I think many journalists who, you know, the journalists there are very, very close. Everyone knows everyone else. And, this takes place 2 weeks after an Al Jazeera journalist was killed along with some colleagues. In that case, Israel insisted that he had been a former Hamas terrorist, or that he was a Hamas member. Obviously, Jazeera and others have disputed that. So it's becoming, I think, incredibly dangerous for all Gazans at this point. And unfortunately, we're not seeing any signs that this campaign is letting up. Ceasefire talks unraveled completely last week, and it seems that Israel is bent on taking Gaza City, which is to the north of Khan Yunis, where there are hundreds of thousands of people who are now flooding to the south as well. Unfortunately, it looks like this is going to continue, even though there's immense international pressure, I think, on both sides to call a ceasefire.
Thank you very much, Sama Al Atrosh, the Times Middle East correspondent. Coming up, what's behind Emma Raducanu's reinvigoration at the US Open? Well, we want to know that. And the time, it's 24 minutes past two. And I'm Richard Coles, sitting in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
To whoever finds this letter, my car broke down. There is nothing nearby. And I've already eaten my meal deal sandwich. Please tell my wife that I love her and that she was right. This jacket isn't waterproof. Signed, Daniel S.
Oh, actually, scrap that. Greenflakes just arrived. Blimey, less than an hour.
Local rescue, nationwide. Nothing beats near. Greenflag.
On average, we get to breakdowns in under an hour based on app and phone callouts combined between July 24 and June 25.
It's a chilled summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. It's like an MOT for your boiler. Just £79, reduced from £109. Bliss! Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas, taking care of things. Visit britishgas.co.uk to learn more and see full T's and C's. Sale ends 9th of September 2025. Offer available to new boiler service contract customers.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Final tennis Grand Slam of the year is now in full swing. The tournament's already seen drama involving former champions. The 2021 men's winner, Daniil Medvedev, was knocked out in the first round after a meltdown caused by a photographer walking on the court. British number one, Emma Raducanu, also played last night and was looking for a first win since her title win 4 years ago. To tell us more about the Open, TalkSport's Lisa O'Sullivan joins me now. Lisa, great drama at the Medvedev match. What was going on, do you think?
Yeah, good afternoon, Richard. Hi. Unbelievable scenes, and you say that quite often when Medvedev is playing in New York, where in 2019 he was very much the villain of the piece and he G'd up the crowd until he won over their respect by taking Rafa Nadal to five sets in the final, went on to become the champion in 2021. But it was ridiculous what happened yesterday. So Benjamin Bonzi, who had beaten Daniil Medvedev in the first round at Wimbledon in a five-set match earlier this year, had match point. So he was serving 5-4 up, two sets to one up, when a photographer decided to walk on the court to get a better position. So literally, potentially the final point of the match, this photographer had no idea what was going through his mind. So the chair umpire stuck to the rules and awarded Benjamin Bonzi another first serve. So he had another two shots at getting the match point. Well, Medvedev didn't like that because he thought, well, he's only got one shot at it, surely, but he hasn't. The rules, the chair umpire was correct. But what Medvedev did was whip up the crowd. And we're talking about, I think it was probably about midnight at this point, or heading towards midnight, and got the whole of the crowd shouting, and it was 6 minutes before the match actually resumed. It did go to another five sets, but Benjamin Bonzi went on to win the match, and Medvedev was left smashing a racket and in tears at the end. And his post-match press conference was really quite sad, because, you know, he's talking about perhaps it's ready to call a time because he's had such terrible form with his tennis of late as well. So he was just left wondering what's next for him. I don't think he will retire. He's still too good for that, but he really needs to find his way because he's just playing just dreadful tennis.
Like a racket, he is highly strung, perhaps. Forgive me. I'm sorry, I don't know anything about tennis, as you can obviously tell. Bonti seemed to enjoy the moment as well. There was a cheeky cupping of the ear towards the crowd's booze, wasn't there, as he enjoyed his moment of victory?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he played that. He played it brilliantly. He also thanked them for their booze. And that, I don't know if that was deliberate or not, but that was something that Medvedev did, very easy to say, back in 2019 when he was, you know, vilified by the New York crowd. The tennis in New York is nothing like Wimbledon. If you've been to Wimbledon, you've got all the calmness and the serenity and the quietness, and you can hear almost the strings singing as the ball pings off them. New York, they're eating hot dogs, there's music playing, they'll shout at the players. I mean, the tennis seems to almost sometimes be the sideshow. And Medvedev seems to really know how to harness that. But Benjamin Bonti, cupping his ear, as you say, to the crowd and then thanking them for their booze, seemed to me a direct copy of what Medvedev said all those years ago. But I'm not entirely sure that Bonti knew that that's exactly what Medvedev had done.
Do you think we're seeing kind of more drama happening off the court, if I can put, we're at the edge of the court now? Is that just now part of the modern game?
Well, the interesting thing, of course, is that there are no chair umpires. There are no line judges. So if you watched Wimbledon this year, the courts all looked a lot roomier, a lot bigger, because there were a lot fewer people actually on the playing surface and a lot less furniture around the actual playing surface of the courts, because the line judge is just physically not there. How a photographer managed to actually get onto the court at that point of the match is utterly beyond me. And, you know, the chair umpire, Greg Allensworth, called him straight away, said, stop, oi, you, get out. That photographer's also had his accreditation cut now. He's been ejected from the tournament as a result. But he would have known that you don't do that. It was something I used to be a club swimmer, you know, like you do when you're a kid. And my permanent fear was that I would accidentally fall into the pool when somebody else was swimming, which would be an automatic disqualification, and I'd get banned from swimming for life. So I stayed away from the edge of the lane. Quite how that photographer managed to get onto the court is a really big question. Maybe at that point in the match.
Well, I don't know, maybe there's a sort of stress testing of the tolerances now, because obviously the kind of stakes rise in every sense around these games, and that means that you're going to see more frequent trespasses across what were hitherto observed guidelines, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, potentially that. But yeah, it's cost him 2 weeks' work, definitely. Or perhaps further, you know.
Good news if you're interested in British tennis. Emma Raducanu putting in a strong performance. What happened with her?
Yeah, so you mentioned that she was looking for her first win since she took the title in that remarkable competition in 2021, and she was looking pretty good. 6-2, 6-1 in 62 minutes, her victory over Shibahara Aina of Japan. And it was confident, it was good. And we're seeing something that we've heard before. She's got a new coach, but the guy that she's working with now, Francisco Roig, used to work with Rafa Nadal and help Rafa Nadal get his 22 Grand Slam titles. So I think Raducanu, who started her career in such an extraordinary way, doing something that is nigh on impossible, going through qualifying, winning a tournament without dropping a set as a complete unknown, is effectively, you know, kind of where a lot of other players would have been back then. She's building again now, and she's getting those results. She's had a good year. Her body's stronger. Some of those niggles that we've seen seem to have been addressed, and she can actually just focus on hitting the ball. And it was a really good win. And she said she was nervous because it was the first match of the day on the Sunday at the US Open, and 11 o'clock in the morning. She said, well, nobody wants to be out before lunchtime. And, you know, she guaranteed that she's through. And she's got another test, the tough one, actually, she's playing next, because she's playing Janice, Janice Teen Chen. That's it, Janice Chen of Indonesia. She's the first Indonesian to make the second round of a Grand Slam, to score a win in a Grand Slam competition. She's one of these young players that's coming through that's really going to have people talking in years to come. So I think Raducanu also knows that, you know, the first win's under the belt, but the second one's no easy win either.
Well, we'll watch this space. TalkSport journalist Lisa O'Sullivan, thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, where's the best place to get a last-minute holiday deal? Well, we'll tell you after the news with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Five journalists are among 20 people killed in an Israeli strike on a hospital in Gaza, according to officials there. The IDF says it's investigating the attack on the Nasser hospital and insists it doesn't target journalists. Al Jazeera has confirmed one of its staff, Mohammed Salama, has died. Mohammed Mawawad, the managing editor of the broadcaster, says those working in the area will continue to report on what's happening.
We are very committed to continuing the coverage. All of them say that this is our story, those are our people, and we are here committed to this profession, to this journalism, and we want to make sure that the story is out to the world.
Witnesses say a helicopter spiraled out of control before crashing on the Isle of Wight. One person has been taken to hospital while it thought four people were on board in total. Sir Starmer is facing pressure over the small boats crisis after ongoing protests outside asylum hotels. A new poll suggests the Prime Minister is failing to control the problem, despite ministers setting out measures to speed up removals. 10 organisations have written to the Home Secretary expressing deep concern about the government's strategy to tackle violence against women and girls. It's after a leaked Home Office document says victims of child sexual abuse won't be in the scope of the plans. And applications to UK agricultural colleges are up, driven by the popularity of Clarkson's Farm. The Royal Agricultural University saw an 11% rise in rural land management courses and an 18% boost in farm placement programmes. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs, and a smart meter can help. Aaron Sarney's family own Twinkle Toes, the largest children's shoe retailer in Sheffield. He uses his smart meter to find ways to cut his energy costs.
Well, we chose to get a smart meter because what we didn't really know is what our daily consumption was, and so we just wanted to target, are there ways that we can actually go and see what we were using it on and that sort of thing. We have identified some areas where we've managed to save energy. The lights are used for 8 hours a day, so we can go and change the actual lighting to LED. And secondly, in the stockroom, for instance, if we introduce LED sensors, it will help reduce usage when no one's actually in the stockroom. Smart meter is a great tool. I would certainly recommend it to other businesses because it's certainly been a wonderful tool to help our business to actually understand our energy usage.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
John Peet now joins us. John, what's coming up on your show?
Hello, Richard. So I'm looking at a number of stories. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in the news agenda today. But when it comes to Gaza, first of all, I'm going to be talking to a doctor who's actively working at the Nasser Hospital that was the subject. I would say target. Israel denies that it was a target, but certainly the hospital that was hit in those strikes over the last hours. His thoughts on what it would be like to try and do your job as a doctor in a hospital struck twice by missiles, according to reports. And Israel looking, it is said, at what went on there. I mean, how difficult is it to get medics and others to work in Gaza to do the vital work that they do now? And how do Israel's denial of targeting hospitals and others who should not be targeted, how does that square with the evidence of what's happened so far? So looking at all of that. We're going to hear from Donald Trump. He's in the White House with the leader of South Korea at around 5 o'clock. So you never quite know what you're going to get with Donald Trump, but so we're going to find out by crossing into the White House live and talking to Molly Ball from the Wall Street Journal. I'm also interested in the story of pharmaceutical companies and how they are doing what they do against the background of the government putting a cap on spending on medicines in this country, which is so much lower by comparison with other countries in Europe, and patients who are denied vital, life-saving or life-prolonging medications in this country that would not be denied in other countries. So that and other stories too, Richard.
Great. Thank you very much, John. Looking forward to it. Right, looking forward to holidays too. Parts of the country could reach 30 degrees Celsius this bank holiday, they say, with the Midlands and Northwest set to see the highest temperatures. But it will be short-lived, alas, as the remains of Hurricane Erin are predicted to bring in blustery winds and rain across the UK. To cheer us up, we hope, Laura Jackson, Deputy Head of Travel at The Times, is here with the best last-minute holiday deals to prolong what is on track to be the UK's hottest summer on record. Where should we be jetting off to, Laura?
Well, if you haven't booked something for September, it isn't too late. There are some fantastic deals out there. And I think September, the thing that I've seen really in the 20 years I've been doing this job, is September is more popular than ever. More of us are choosing to travel in what used to be off-peak, but now feels like a peak time. Temperatures are a bit lower across Europe. There are some fantastic bargains. That does mean, though, you've got to look in the corners and to find those. So one of the first things I would say is don't forget about the UK. Obviously, temperatures are going to be a bit lower, but because of the weather, we are seeing some deals out there. So Premier Cottages have loads of cash off of their cottages. So one of the deals that I found, you can save 55% between the 5th and 8th of September at a place called Bray Cottage near Holmfirth. There's a beautiful hotel up near Whitby that we absolutely love on the Times and Sunday Times. It was one of our top 100 places to stay for the year, Saltmore. And they have just launched the Beach House, which is one of their new special little properties towards the beach. It's 5 minutes away from the main property. It's a really romantic location. So if you're a couple looking for somewhere special to stay, that would be my top pick right now.
Recommend it to young vampires in particular, with the Bram Stoker connection, right, Whitby?
Or Love Island fans, because the hotel is actually owned by Montana Brown, who was on Love Island. It's an absolutely spectacular spot. She's got a real eye for design. Elsewhere, though, I think always my top pick for a September break is Harnia in Crete, Western Crete. The airport makes it a lot easier to get there than ever before. More people are flying. EasyJet fly from Gatwick, and they also fly from Bristol. And it's really worth looking for that western part, because you do tend to find that in sort of Santorini, Mykonos, the Cyclades, it's starting to get a little bit windier at this time of year. And I find that Western Crete, it's not going to be breeze-free, but temperatures are still going to be in the late 20s.
It's like promising no midges in Scotland in September. You might get lucky, you might not, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the weather is always difficult, but Crete, I would say, even into the sort of second week in October, is still really, really worth the effort. Although the one thing I would check about all these places that are off-peak is that there are hotels, restaurants and things open. Greece does tend to start shutting down towards the end of September. So do just check, you know, locally with opening times that things are going to be available, because you don't want to get somewhere having got a fantastic deal and then find there's nowhere open to eat out.
If you're not particularly interested in vampires, Love Island or beach holidays, what might be your bargain options?
Well, my pick right now is Jordan, so stay with me. It is safe and it's really great value right now. Obviously, there's been a lot of things going on in the Middle East, which I think have impacted numbers there. I don't have any actual official figures from Jordan, but it's safe to say that numbers are down. But now, if you've ever wanted to visit Petra, which is obviously, you know, one of the world's most brilliant historic sites, I would say that now is a really great time to go. There's going to be fewer visitors and there are bargains out there. Exodus have got a fantastic tour at the moment that's really luxurious. You're in five-star hotels all the way, and there's about £500 off of that. So it's down to £2,000.
How do they do that? How do they shave 500 quid off the price of that holiday? Is it simply they've just got to fill places?
Well, some of it is to do with last-minute availability, absolutely. Yeah. Some of it is the fact that they will have booked those rooms in advance, tour operators. So they will have made an estimate of what they're going to sell, and if they don't sell it, it then goes to discount.
This year's travel trends, Laura, has it been a year that has vindicated the professionals' trend prophecy, if I can put it that way?
Well, I think the big things that we've seen this year are people travelling more and for shorter periods of time. One of my areas of specialism is city breaks. And I'm definitely seeing on the Times a lot of our readers want to go to cities that are perhaps a bit off the beaten track. So not necessarily Paris and not necessarily Berlin, but places like Lausanne in Switzerland. I was there just last week. I think Vienna is always my top pick for European capitals. And I think we have definitely seen a real sense of people wanting to know the minutiae before they go. They want to know, you know, people are asking me, who is going to be my guide if I'm going on safari? you know, exactly what room should I be staying in? I think people have got pickier than ever.
Because they've just got more information, that it's much easier to have a look and see what others have said about it, perhaps, or compare with other websites.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more information than ever. But also, I think people are still spending, people still want to go on holiday. It's one of the things that we're not cutting back on, but we are all being a bit more careful about where we're placing that money, and we want that sense of reassurance.
And information is king, isn't it? I was thinking, I was in Edinburgh recently, and Edinburgh in August, I think, would not be somewhere I would readily recommend to people, simply because there's so many people there, and it's just simply more people per square foot than is comfortable. The same thing in Venice, of course, and lots of other places. So pick your city wisely.
Yeah, I mean, for example, Venice, absolutely fantastic in November. And I went last year in November, having previously been only in the summertime. And, you know, you're always worrying that someone's going to topple off into a canal. But in November, it was absolutely perfect. Still great weather. Didn't need my big coat. Didn't have to book for any restaurants. Got a great deal on a hotel that was less than £200 a night. I really felt like I got some incredible value out of that weekend. Whereas you go in July and it can feel really quite claustrophobic in its own way.
So picking wisely can really save you some money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think obviously doing your research, seeing what's out there, but I think one of my key messages is that booking a late deal doesn't always mean that it's going to be cheaper. One of the things that I've seen this year is deals that were perhaps, you know, £1,500 for a 7-night holiday somewhere in January, that might now be creeping up into £1,600 or £1,700. So I do think actually for next year, booking that bit earlier and perhaps not leaving it right to the last moment is actually a really good tip.
Next year, Laura, people having holiday blues in anticipation. Do you have any early predictions for where we should be looking?
Well, next year, I think we're seeing more flight routes back into the Caribbean. Virgin are launching to Cancun 3 times a week. I still think City Break is going to be massively popular. I'm a massive fan of cruising personally. There's lots of exciting things happening in the cruise sphere. And I think for me, the main thing is just travelling smarter. So really travelling responsibly. So if I'm going for a 48-hour city break in somewhere like New York, really extending that trip out and maybe going for a week or so, so I'm getting bolting on a city break with perhaps a road trip, for example.
Laura Jackson, thank you very much. Deputy Head of Travel at the Times, of course. Now, pro-democracy campaigner, media mogul and British citizen Jimmy Lai has been imprisoned in China for 5 years and put on trial for 2. As that trial ends, the Story podcast asks what will happen to one of China's most prominent critics and if the UK government or Donald Trump can save him. On Friday's episode, Manveen Rana spoke to Cindy Yu, columnist and contributing editor at The Times and Sunday Times.
Donald Trump has said that he would do whatever he can to release Jimmy Lai. Keir Starmer has raised the issue every time he has met with Chinese delegations. The Canadian government has also made statements on it. Various democratic governments have spoken out in support. He also has many grassroots Hong Kong activist groups, you know, rooting for him. But none of them are really in a good place to get Beijing to decide otherwise. Because unlike other political hostages, unlike other political prisoners that Beijing has taken, Jimmy Lai isn't just a hostage in a kind of uncomfortable or tense bilateral relation moment. He has connections and he is so much more an intractable case for the party, so much more of a powerful opponent, someone who strikes fear. He is someone who, if released, could very well keep making trouble.
Yeah.
You know, there's no...
This is despite the fact that he is a British citizen. He has a British passport.
Yeah, exactly. And has had for almost half of his life. But it just kind of is dispiriting in some ways to show how sovereign governments, how limited they can be in securing the freedoms of their citizens.
If the government was to try and do something, how much leverage do they have? How much would they be able to influence China?
So one thing that was suggested to me by Sam Goodman, who is a policy analyst in this area, was that actually the UK has seized billions of pounds worth of scammed money from China, where these Chinese scammers commit crimes in China, take the money and come to the UK. And last year there was a heist of Bitcoin worth £3 billion from Chinese scammers. So could something like that be literally paid back as a ransom of sorts? Or another example suggested to me by Mark Clifford, Lai's biographer, is the super embassy that is so controversial at the moment. China wants to use the Royal Mint site to create the biggest embassy it has in Europe. It's outgrown its current site in Portland Place, but it is very politically controversial. You know, a lot of critics have pointed out security concerns about it, espionage concerns, all sorts of things. But Mark said to me, you know, what if you had a bit of a quiet deal? We'll let the embassy go ahead. You let Jimmy go. And when I said to him, I think politically that would never satisfy voters in the country who are, generally speaking, still quite sceptical of China. Mark had a really interesting example from the Cuban Missile Crisis, where a secret deal had been done with Cuba to remove missiles from Turkey by the Americans. And it didn't come out until years afterwards. So it's a kind of grotty political deals that maybe happen every day behind the scenes. And I would be, you know, I'd be delighted if that was the case. But it doesn't seem like at the moment from the outside that it is happening.
And for us, you know, you can understand, as you say, if you do that thought experiment, you can understand that for Beijing, he is such a useful prisoner. His being behind bars sort of is a great symbol of the end of free speech and democracy and the two systems idea in Hong Kong. That's gone. Yeah. For the West, equally though, doesn't he become a symbol? Isn't he somebody we should be fighting for? Or what happens to our values?
Well, I think he is a symbol. But call me a pessimist, Manveen, but I think people forget about symbols all the time. I guess I'm quite cynical about how much this kind of adulation coming from the West, genuine as it is, will really help his case.
That was Cindy Yu, columnist and contributing editor at The Times and Sunday Times, speaking to Manveen Rana. And you can hear the full episode on today's The Story podcast, one story told in depth each day. It's available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, why has the debate around migration become so toxic? It is about 10 to 3, and this is Richard Coles sitting in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon, your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Tesco Finest Sugar Bell Tomatoes, the ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe, to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
It's the last few days of the Furniture Village sale, with final reductions on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture. And the savings don't stop there, with extra offers this bank holiday. Many offers end Bank Holiday Monday in the Furniture Village sale.
Running a business can be expensive, which is why at NFU Mutual, we don't charge admin fees with our trades insurance, so you can easily make changes when you need to. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. For quality trades insurance to suit all sizes, search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
After a summer of protests against asylum policy, it appears the public's losing faith in the government's ability to handle the small boats crisis. A YouGov poll for The Times found 71% of voters believe the Prime Minister's handling the asylum hotel issue badly. But why does this debate spark such strong reactions? A number of MPs are complaining about online abuse linked to the immigration debate. Labour peer Lord Dubs, who came to the UK on the Kinder transport in 1939, joins me now. Lord Dubs, what is it about migration, this debate in particular, that makes everyone so easily inflamed, do you think?
Well, you have to ask them. But I think it's very, very disappointing, because the majority of people in this country are supportive of asylum seekers. They understand what these people have been through in their own countries, whether it's Syria or Afghanistan or Sudan. They know about that, and they want to be supportive. But we've got a minority who are seeking to cause violence against people in hotels. Now, the traffickers are horrible people. Of course we've got to deal with them. Of course they've got to be stopped. Of course people who don't qualify for asylum under the Geneva Convention should be sent back. All that should happen. And indeed it is happening. But we've still got people who are not listening to what the truth is about the people who've arrived.
A small minority, but a very noisy minority. We hear an awful lot from them and about them. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they've been whipped up. Look, under the last government, there was a Conservative Home Secretary who called people coming invaders. Now, invaders are normally regarded as the enemy. And I think what we have to have is senior politicians in all parties speaking up and saying to people, this is a situation, this is why people have fled to safety. If they qualify as refugees, we should give them safety. Not all of them, but at least some of them, along with our European friends.
Do you think part of the problem, though, is a perception, and maybe a growing perception, that the government has kind of lost its grip and that makes people feel nervous, anxious, threatened, perhaps?
Well, I think they may do, yes. I understand that. I don't think the government has lost its grip. I think they inherited a dreadful situation, but it's taking time to get sorted. But in the meantime, people are lacking in confidence in the government. I hope that the government's measures will work. Look, I don't speak for the government, and I can be critical as a friend, as well as a friend of the government. But I think the government has to do more to achieve better relations with our European friends. Then that will work. We've already got to deal with France. We need more of those sort of deals in order to make the whole thing work.
People in public life, especially I think parliamentarians, have to have thick skins. It's, as you say, a culture in which criticism is offered freely from all quarters. But do you think there's something different, something more intense about the kind of abuse that some MPs have reported experiencing?
Well, it's not the most recent thing, of course. We had two members of parliament murdered in their constituencies not all that long ago while they were doing work on behalf of their constituents. So this hostility has been going for some time. And I don't think a democracy works properly unless there is respect by people for the ones they elect. Of course, there are some bad apples among the people that get elected, but on the whole, most MPs do a pretty conscientious job. I may not agree with some of them, the Conservative ones in particular, but they try and do a conscientious job. And I think they do deserve a better environment than simply to be abused and threatened with violence, particularly women politicians. They're having a terrible time in terms of the threats to their safety, and I think that's completely unacceptable.
Do you think that social media might play its part here? I mean, there's something about the kind of megaphone quality that it has, and also, to mix a metaphor, the kind of road rage thing is that people don't always realise that they're connecting with people on the other end of their invective.
Well, I think both of those, yes. I think the social media have a part to play. Of course, people of my age don't watch the social media as much as younger people. But social media does give rise to instant messaging. And the trouble is it gives rise to false rumours as well. And that sort of exacerbates the situation. We've seen people, they rush along to a hostel because they think somebody in there has done something dreadful. May not be that person at all. Person may not have been charged yet. But people come to rapid conclusions. And I think the social media help them to come to those conclusions, which is unfortunate. That's why senior politicians of all parties have to speak out and say, this is what the truth is. We are a better country than is suggested by these nasty attacks on people in hotels.
And do you think Parliament or perhaps other official bodies could offer a better protection to MPs, in both houses, appears as well, I mean, when they are targeted by this kind of abuse?
Well, clearly the two that were murdered were a sign that there wasn't proper protection. Yeah. But then again, MPs have to be free to, as it were, be easily accessible to their constituents. And there lies the dilemma. If you make them too secure, they're not accessible to their constituents and they become even more remote than they're accused of being anyway. So I think there's a real dilemma, and we have to get the right balance between accessibility to constituents, making it easier for constituents to meet their MPs and tell them what they think, and providing safety. And I think the police have a really difficult job to get the balance right.
There's a larger problem, perhaps, down the line, which is... I mean, you just wonder who would want to be an MP now if you look at how much of a target of abuse, how difficult the job is and how angry their critics are. Do you think it's something that might dissuade people from considering a career in public life to be on the receiving end of that?
I fear it might, particularly women, who are so much more the subject of abuse than men. Yes, and I think our democracy will be much poorer if that happens, because we want to have the best people seeking to get into Parliament, the best people of all backgrounds, men and women as well as men. And if we don't achieve that, then we're weakening our democracy, and the House of Commons will become a less representative place and therefore less effective in dealing with the issues of the day.
Do you think it's also perhaps symptomatic of our times that the centre does not hold, if I can put it that way, and that creates just more turbulence at the edges of debate? So that becomes more inflammatory, and that changes the kind of colour and the texture of the whole thing.
I think we've seen that in other countries. We've seen it in the United States, for example,
yeah.
And we've seen it in quite a lot of European countries. Yes, the centre may not be holding very well, and it's up to people who are in the centre, if they're prepared to be labelled that way, people in the centre, to speak up and let their voice be heard. But we need leadership from the top. We need leadership from the top in every European country, and sadly that's been lacking in recent years, and the extreme right in some European countries have been doing rather well by exploiting the refugee situation. There's something very visible. In the old days, people used to come on the back of a lorry or on the Eurostar somehow, illegally. Now they come on boats, and they're so much more visible to the television cameras, and that is, again, unfortunate. But I think the centre has a lot to answer for in terms of how we handle things, particularly political leaders in all countries, including this one.
What do you think they should be doing that they're not doing?
I think they have to be explaining why it is that we have a responsibility, along with other countries, to give safety to people who are fleeing from persecution. Look, most of the people coming in this country are not asylum seekers and not on boats. They are people who are coming under our immigration system because we need them for our job market, for the health service, for social care and so on. But I think we also have to make it clear that those people, and the numbers that are coming in boats are far too large, they should be zero, but the number coming that way, many of them are fleeing from the most awful situations. I remember talking to a Syrian boy some time ago whose father had been blown up by a bomb in front of him in Aleppo or Damascus. These are terrible things that have happened to people,
yeah.
And they're fleeing from enormous threats to their safety, and that has to be explained to people. And when local communities are made aware of it, then local communities up and down the country become very supportive, and I salute them for that.
Do you think it's a danger that the whole conversation gets narrowed, Lord Dubs, that the difficult conversations are harder to have if people are worried about this kind of abuse?
Yes, it is. We're not being very calm about it. And indeed, so much of the debate is now being taken up by the safety of MPs and about people coming on boats. And yes, it is unfortunate. This is not the way politics ought to go. But then if people feel strongly about it, it's up to politicians to meet those concerns and explain what the situation is. And I'm afraid we're not doing that very much.
Thank you so much. That's Lord Alf Dubs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Richard Cole sitting in for Jane and Fee. Still to come, why Gen Z wants to get back in the office. Stat. Plus, the best book recommendations from Laura Cook and money advice for the soon-to-be student in your life. But first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Israel says it would investigate claims from Gaza's health ministry that at least 20 people were killed in strikes on a hospital in the south of the enclave. 5 journalists are reportedly among the dead after an attack on the Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis. The Israeli military says it regrets any harm to uninvolved individuals, adding it doesn't target journalists. Consultant surgeon Professor Nick Maynard previously volunteered at the hospital.
What's happening now is barbarism in the extreme. I left Nasser just about 4 weeks ago. It's been bombed several times in the last 22 months.
Sakir Starmer is facing pressure to take a more radical approach to the small boats crisis, as a YouGov survey for The Times shows 7 out of 10 people believe he's handling the issue of asylum hotels badly. That number includes over half of Labour voters. In a bid to address concerns, Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, announced plans to overhaul the asylum appeal system to deport asylum seekers faster. Political correspondent Terry Stiasny told Times Radio this pressure isn't going away.
This does seem to be also an issue that's increasing in significance for voters who are asked about it, with 37% of people now saying that immigration and asylum is the most important issue facing the country. And if you look at similar polls in the past, those have usually been things like the economy and health, and those seem to be less salient at the moment.
Witnesses say a helicopter spiralled out of control before crashing on the Isle of Wight. One person has been taken to hospital while it's thought 4 people were on board in total. The number of violent crimes and sex offences against women and girls on the railways has seen a rise, according to figures from the British Transport Police. The number of violent crimes jumped by 5% in the year to the end of March, while the number of sexual offences rose by 10% during the same period. The National Police Chiefs Council has previously described such crimes as a national emergency. Rail bosses are stepping up efforts to combat what they've called an epidemic of offending. And almost 800 shoplifting offences are going unsolved every day. That's according to latest figures from the House of Commons Library. The Met Police has the worst record, with only 5.9% of cases resulting in a charge in 2024 to 2025. Former Scotland Yard detective Mike Neville says technology could be used more effectively.
In the police, there's an obsession with this live facial recognition, which is all very good and useful at Notting Hill Carnival. They could solve thousands more crimes if they used it effectively in these situations.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Very good afternoon. I'm Richard Cole, sitting in for Fee and Jane in a light insulated studio on a lovely, lovely day. I'll be talking shop, church shop, with Reverend Fergus Butler Galley in a moment, whose new book discusses a dozen churches from Bethlehem to Massachusetts, which he considers significant in the story of Christianity, and yet no Lincoln Cathedral. What's that about? We'll find out. Working from home has proved disappointing to many Gen Zs, who are dying to get to the office. We'll ask why. Student finance is our topic on Money Matters as people head out into tertiary education. We'll be looking at summer reading with books person Laura Hackett. Now, 12 churches, 12 stories from around the world. The Reverend Fergus Butler Galley takes us on a journey through Christianity's history and its place in today's world, exploring faith, power, hope and conflict. And Fergus, a.k.a. Vicar of Charlesbury, joins me now. Fergus, you're never going to pick 12 churches to the satisfaction of anybody, at least not another parson. Why did you pick these? No.
Well, it was a little tricky, to be honest. I had to pick 12 that represented the breadth of Christianity, the breadth of denominations, the geographical breadth and the historical breadth. So once I had those categories in place, as much as I would have liked to have picked my sort of 12 favourite that I remember kneeling at in prayer, that wasn't really possible. I had to have something with a bit of global heft to it and something that represented the full panoply of denominations that we have. So those were my main sort of factors rather than personal affection, I'm afraid.
It's interesting because one of the things that comes across very strongly from your choice and the way you write about them is the actually notion that Christianity is still a rapidly evolving story. What was happening somewhere once is happening very differently somewhere else now.
Absolutely. And I think we can, it's very easy in England in particular to think that, you know, Christianity is exclusively the kind of world of, old maid cycling to Holy Communion and well-worn prayers and Victorian brasses, which, you know, I love as much as the next sort of romantically inclined parson. But actually, Christianity is this astonishing global movement. There really hasn't been anything like it before or since, and it continues to evolve and shape, particularly the growing world in Africa and Asia in ways that I think we can't even begin to fathom here in the West.
I think in the traditional centres of Christianity, but certainly in Britain, the story is one of perhaps cathedrals having to close their doors for certain days of the week because costs are so difficult to meet. And you feel that Christianity is at the kind of end of a cycle. It's very different, isn't it, when you go to other parts of the world and you see a very resurgent Christianity, a very buoyant Christianity. And the stories of those churches there tell that wider story.
Absolutely. And the world is getting more Christian, not less, and more religious, not less. And that can sometimes be difficult. I think we in the West are quite used to controlling the narrative or being the focal point, the center point of the narrative. And that's increasingly not the case. And nothing is that more true than religion and Christianity in particular.
What is the... I was just look at some of your choices. The Church of the Holy Nativity at Bethlehem, the famously tiny door through which you enter into the vast expanse of this story, which, according to the tradition, began there. It's very different, isn't it, from the kind of postmodern churches you might find elsewhere. But there are continuities. Of course there are. They're the place where Christians go to encounter each other and God in that unique way.
Absolutely. I think at the heart of every church building, and this will make me sound very Church of England, but it is paradox. You know, it's where humans go to encounter the divine. It's where people go for their highest moments of joy and their deepest moments of grief. And what is in the heart of Bethlehem is the paradox of God made man in Christ. And so I felt I had to start with Bethlehem, not only because, of course, that's where the story starts. Everybody knows, you know, the greatest story ever told, and a story that, you know, I've heard it goodness knows how many times, still moves me every year. I'm not a great Christmas fan, but I have to say Luke's narrative in particular of the infancy of Christ is, you know, it hits me with a power every single year. Not only because, you know, that's where that story is set, but Bethlehem sets the tone for every church ever since, because every church then has the possibility to be a Bethlehem, a place where humanity encounters God on our own kind of terms, on the terms of flesh. And it's an incredible thing, really, when you think about it. And the fact that that is still the aspiration for, as you say, these kind of soaring Gothic cathedrals or these postmodern blocks somewhere in the New World, the fact that they are all trying to do the same thing as Bethlehem is quite an astonishing thing, really.
It's also where humanity encounters humanity in its glory, yes, and its terror. And that is a story which is both light and dark, often simultaneously.
Absolutely, and nowhere better encapsulates that than Bethlehem. You know, there's a ladder that's still leaning against a wall in Bethlehem that's been there since, I think, 1876, because nobody knows whose job it is to move it. And you have all these conflicting monks who have these sort of slightly queeny outbursts of venom against each other at key moments in the church year because they want to sweep this step or they want to, you know, walk along this particular cloister. So yes, Bethlehem certainly shows that kind of ridiculous side of humanity, that there's this squabbling that goes on there. But it's also a place of tragedy. You know, of the churches which I write about, it was the most difficult one to visit. Indeed, I did not visit Bethlehem because it is currently in the midst of the most tragic and violent warfare, you know, on the planet. It's not as bad as Gaza in the West Bank, but there's still a great deal of violence. It's very difficult for people to visit. And it's still the case that, you know, this is a place that gives such hope to people across the world, and yet in its own particularities suffers each and every day. So, yes, there's the dark side of the paradox as well.
Halfway across the world, another church witnessing to another kind of violence and awfulness. And I'm thinking of the Baptist churches in the segregationist American South, as well.
Yes, the 16th church in Birmingham, Alabama, 16th Street Baptist, which is really the place where actually the civil rights movement turns. It's where the Klan in 1963 plants a bomb that kills four young girls who are getting ready for Sunday school. And it is sort of the moment where the horror of life for many, many people, black people in the segregated South, becomes a reality for the rest of America, and particularly Christian America. And it's a place where I spoke to Pastor Price, who is the pastor there, and he talked about it needing to become a place that is sort of an arena of hope, but it can do that more effectively because it has known pain. And again, that's one of the other paradoxes that I found as I went through these churches. It tended to be the ones that had known violence or sadness that then become more authentic places of healing in some ways, because they've known these appalling acts.
You also visit cloister churches, which have very deliberately set themselves or attempted to set themselves apart from the kind of wheel and woe of everyday existence. The cloister is also a feature of these places.
Absolutely. I got to go to Mount Athos, and I went not long after the king's coronation, and all the monks were very pleased that he'd had, you know, Orthodox blessed oil and Orthodox chanting. And they said, well, you have an Orthodox king now. And of course, he's half Greek. And it was funny, you know, because they wanted to speak to me about the outside world, about that. I went just after Wimbledon. One of the monks had been a junior tennis champion in Athens. And he was endlessly wanting to talk to me about Wimbledon that year. So there's this sort of astonishing, you know, reality of the outside world. And yet these are men who forswear all female contact. There are no women on Athos. It's a place that deliberately cuts itself off from the world. And yet a place where you kind of do see these encounters of humanity, but encounters with the divine as well. And the rhythm of it is exceptionally moving, to be woken up on under this clear sky at 4 a.m. by people chanting the praises of God. It's mystical and strange and very different to what we're used to in our normal lives, but it works. And I think that's something that's quite kind of moving in its own way.
I'm very much hoping you visited the one where they hoist you up in a basket, because that's a pleasing image to conjure for us.
I might need a slightly reinforced basket for me, I'm afraid. But
well, I think that
when they had the technology.
I think they have baskets for the stouter parson, so have no fear. Long may it continue. I mean, the other contrast which really struck me was one of kind of scale, the grandeur of the church compared with the modesty of the church. I'm thinking, well, the Vatican, of course, nothing grander. Mm. And then there's that lovely church, tiny church you talk about above, on the rocky coast of southern Japan. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, so this is the Koroshitan Hokura, which is a tiny little hidden shrine. It dates from the days of the very vigorous persecution of Christianity that occurs in Japan at the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, where essentially, and those listeners who have seen the film Silence will know the barbarity with which this was done. Essentially, the Japanese government outlaws Christianity and seeks to kill anyone who isn't prepared to give it up. And it leads to some exceptionally kind of violent and heartbreaking moments of martyrdom. But these people in the midst of these horrors still keep their faith, and you have the hidden Christians. So what the shrine on the Japanese coast is, it looks like any other shrine in Japan. But for the people who visited it, it was a kind of testament. You can just about make out kind of crosses and pictures of the Virgin Mary around it. And it, for them, it must have been such a source of hope for the centuries, quite literally centuries of barrenness and lack of hope that seemed to be their normal diet. And yet it was the place where they kept the faith. It's not grand at all, but it has more power in it, really, than perhaps any great cathedral or basilica.
It's a fascinating tour, Fergus. And I'm wondering, what do you hope for people who might follow in your footsteps, stop and go through the door, across the threshold, what do you hope they might encounter?
Well, I hope they'll realise that these places, and you'll know this as well, churches are the most astonishing repositories of story. And they are the place where Christianity does that astonishing thing where through the human it points us to the divine. And these places collect these stories, these encounters over centuries and centuries, generations and generations. And they become these sort of beautiful human libraries that point us towards God. And I just hope that anyone who walks past a door thinks about poking their head in and just encountering some of that, because it really is, it can sort of make your heart sing and your mind expand in ways I don't think any other place can.
Was there anywhere you would really, really have wanted to put in but felt time or maybe circumspection made it a choice you couldn't make?
Well, Jerusalem, for instance, you know, I don't visit any of the churches in Jerusalem. I talk about the concept of the New Jerusalem, attempts to build Jerusalem from Ethiopia to Leeds. But Jerusalem itself doesn't feature. There's also churches that are very dear to me that I mention in passing. St. Margaret's Betherston, just off between the Weald and the Marsh in Kent, where I remember first sort of kneeling and praying. That place, it's not a particularly interesting church. It doesn't have a great history, but for me, it was a place where I sort of first felt the majesty of God. And so I suppose every person would have, like me, a place they wanted to put in that's very personal to them, which means the world, their journey of faith, but in the kind of wider scheme of the history of Christianity is a nowhere. But again, to go back to the start, nowhere is a nowhere. Everywhere is a Bethlehem and everywhere is a Jerusalem.
And yet you still persist in excluding Lincoln Cathedral, the finest church in certainly in these islands, probably anyway.
I do mention it actually in passing, in reference to the very moving plaque on the shrine where there was the shrine of Little St. Hugh, which is one of the darkest moments, actually, of Christianity in these islands, where, where a blood libel is instituted against the Jews of Lincoln. And there is, in fact, a very, very moving plaque, which I would encourage people to go and see. I'm sure you know it, which talks about the failures and the evils of the past and seeking forgiveness and reconciliation. And it's so I do mention it in a sort of footnote. I'm afraid it doesn't get the full pop star billing that its slightly brasher sister at Canterbury gets. But there is, you know, something about that, the site of that shrine, which I think is very moving indeed.
Yeah, and but the scale too, I mean, the sort of grandeur of Lincoln, unimaginable to the medieval mind, and yet that little detail is so telling, isn't it?
Well, it is. And that's, Lincoln is a fantastic cathedral because it was the tallest building on the face of the planet, I think, between the construction of the pyramids and the Eiffel Tower. You know, we can't, as you said, we cannot conceive of the scale. And yet the most beautiful parts of it, I think, are these little moments of human pain and human weakness and human love and human forgiveness that you find even in the shadow of this great kind of medieval beast and feat of engineering. The fact there's still that humanity there is very moving indeed.
Fergus, you seem to be incredibly productive as a priest, not only in your pastoral work, but also in producing such marvellous books. Have you got, what's next, do you think?
Well, I need to think about that. I think there is this sort of, I know my publisher would be eager for me to write something on this phenomenon that we're sort of seeing in the West. This, is there a revival going on? Is there not? And I've got my cynicism about it, but also my hope about it. And I think they'd like me to write something about that. But I'd really like, what I'm really hoping to get into at the moment is pigs. I've become very interested in pigs, but I don't think I'm going to be allowed to write a sort of breed guide just yet. I'll have to do a few more marketable books before I get into the real history of the Gloucester Old Spot.
Well, of course, Parson Woodford wrote rather beautifully about pigs, drunk pigs.
He did indeed.
Yeah.
He did indeed, when they eat the apples in his in his orchard and they get drunk. And yes, I think there's... the clergy, particularly in the Church of England, there's a sort of godly tradition. I like to think of a sort of pantheon of these unlikely saints, people like Woodford and Sidney Smith and even the laterating Dean Swift, kind of looking down on my very tiny efforts. I think there's something in that history of Anglican parsons who sort of managed to try and write something, scribble something down in the midst of all the other things we have to deal with. And I'm very thankful for their godly heritage.
Preach. Thank you very much, Fergus Butler-Galley, Vicar of Charlbury.
Thank you, Richard.
12
Thanks.
Churches is out now. Highly recommended. Now, in the latest twist of the work-from-home productivity debate, many young people are deciding they've had enough of the isolation of remote work and returning to traditional office jobs. According to a report by Bupa, 4 in 10 16 to 24-year-olds said they feel lonely or socially isolated when working remotely or in hybrid arrangements. So to explore what setup really works best, staying remote, going hybrid, or heading back to the office full-time, I'm now joined by Carmen Smith, Applied Cymru Life peer, who's also the youngest member of the House of Lords, and Kerry Cooper, Professor of Organisational Psychology and Health at Manchester University's Business School. Carmen, you're one of the youngest in the Lords. Do you feel this loneliness trend among young workers reflects your own experience or what you hear from your peers? I don't mean your peers in the Lords, I mean your peers in the world.
Thanks, Richard. Yes, when I read this stat earlier today, actually, I wasn't surprised at reading it, as I do think that younger people are more lonely, particularly when working from home. I think that you would agree, and also many listeners would agree, that actually a lot of our strong friendships are made in the workplace, and missing that opportunity to be at work in the workplace, in the office, is a missed opportunity for young people. But I would say that hybrid working is a good balance of both, as there's benefits to working from home and being in the office. But it is really concerning, the statistic about loneliness in young people.
I think it's a bit of a canon, isn't it, this notion that everyone would rather be at home putting their feet out, watching telly or whatever, lying on the sofa. I mean, just a straw poll around the office, an unofficial one. Most of the younger people here all really valued coming to work, coming to the office, not least for the kind of experience of working alongside other people in real time and in real space.
Yeah, there's so many benefits to being in your workplace as well, as you've highlighted there. It's seeing also people in different roles and learning what those different roles entail. But also, I think it's about looking at the office as a different work environment now, where it's more about that team building collaboration, where actually the benefit of working from home sometimes is if someone has a certain project or task that is easier to just do without having to interact with people and to have that more focused time, then that might work better for them. But I guess the point is that we don't need to do all of our work from home or all from the office, but a mixture of both.
Right. And Kerry, you've studied workplace wellbeing for years. Do you think younger workers feeling the effects of loneliness more than older colleagues who might have the same hybrid work patterns? That it didn't just be about being a hybrid work pattern, it's about who you are and where you are in your life.
I think what's happened is, you know, we're now in the hybrid world. And, you know, these young people, I thought they were going to actually return to the office because, you know, that's where they make their social contacts. That's where they learn how to develop themselves and their careers. So I anticipated when the hybrid world came after the pandemic that the young people would not, the Z generation and the young millennials, I thought they would still come in. But I think what actually happened is they came in, but there was nobody else there. So they weren't learning from anybody because the older generations, the millennials, the older millennials and those that crowd weren't in the office to give them the experience they needed. And people, younger people, were also working hybridly. So I think they migrated back to working partly from home, partly from a central office. And now I think they do get lonely. They you know, their social connectedness is very important to them. They meet their future partners, usually through work. They develop themselves through work. And I think what they have found is they are getting more lonely, and the other generations are migrating back as well into the workplace. So they're going to be there for them. So I think there's a combination of that. But what we need is not so much the hybrid world. What we need is flexible working.
Yeah.
Because the evidence on flexible working, that is to say, you're a manager of somebody and you say to them, to your subordinates, your staff, look at what works for you. And then this is what works for me. And let's develop a psychological contract. You know, as long as you come in on these kinds of days, you can do whenever you want to come in, you come in, you can come in 5 days a week, 2 days a week, whatever, as long as you achieve your objective and you come on the days I need you in, and we can come to some kind of an arrangement. Because the evidence overwhelmingly, and I produced a book in 2020 called Flexible Work, which was a scientific book where I asked all the academics in different parts of the world, in Asia, North America, Europe, what works in terms of flexible working. This is a few months before the pandemic hit, and the evidence was overwhelming. When people can work flexibly and given the technology, they can. And that's not hybrid. That means that they do something that suits their needs and the needs of the organization. Then you get productivity. Our productivity before the pandemic, when people were always in the office, was poor. Very poor. We were bottom of the G7 on productivity per capita. So the way we manage human beings is really important, and listening to people and what meets their needs and meets your needs as an employer will deliver to the bottom line, in my view, to the UK. And we need to do that because our productivity is poor.
I'm very interested, Carmen, what it's like for you in a historic institution, some might say a sclerotic institution. I'm not qualified to comment. But do you think that it is particularly, that there's something, you have a particular perspective on this because you work, I presume, with a cohort, many of whom are considerably older than you in terms of your fellow peers. I don't just mean people on the estate of Westminster.
Well, I actually started my career in an office environment where I was in, you know, full time in the office and not working from home, because that was prior to the pandemic. And I think having experienced that, but also experienced fully working from home and working in different types of organisations doing projects, it's meant that I've adapted, I guess, to different environments, and I guess seen like some of the pros and cons from different environments. But personally, I enjoy working with a mixture of people, and I guess that's where I'm at the moment. Is I'm working with lots of different people from very different backgrounds to myself, which I think I benefit from.
Do you benefit also from being around people who have a wealth of experience that only really comes because of the amount of years served, if I can put it that way? There is something about having people who are older and who have that experience around that allows for a transmission of knowledge, experience, nous, resilience, whatever it is.
No, I think so. As I think when we talk about learning from experience, often we do think about how many years someone's been in a role. But I also see the benefit of learning from people of all ages because they have lived a different experience. And how I see that as a good thing in politics, for example, is that if you have younger people in politics, for example, they currently will have experienced the current rental housing crisis in a very different way to other generations and can bring that knowledge and understanding with them. But I think there is something to say for both experience of time, but also of someone doing a role, but also sometimes a fresh experience where, I don't know, since we're talking about offices, going into an office now that might have not changed so much, and you see that there's still a landline phone on the desk, and maybe someone younger would ask, like, well, why is it there? And then they might change they might get rid of them because they realise they don't need them. And I suppose it's about sometimes we think we don't need to change the way that we're working because, you know, we haven't had any issues before. However, actually, we can make things a lot more efficient by just adapting, trying new things. Sometimes they don't work and sometimes they work very well. And in this current context with working from home, there's some companies that are doing really good things. They've learnt how to work with their workers, having like full on team, like everyone comes in on a Wednesday. So they have that type of collaboration day, whereas in the past you wouldn't have that. So it's just about, I suppose, evolving the ways that we constantly are working to make it more efficient.
Yeah. I mean, Kerry, I've just had an experience. I've been making a documentary and I've been working with people who are either 20 years or sometimes 40 years younger than me. I'm in my early 60s. And I found that experience certainly done wonders for my productivity because I found it exhilarating and exciting and surprising and have a sit down a couple of times while they were still charging on. But do you think there's a relationship? Can you see in the stats a relationship between the interaction generationally in that way and productivity?
Oh, yeah, I agree with you entirely. I mean, I'm very productive as an academic because of my students.
Yeah,
I mean, they're the ones who stimulate me. You know, my PhD students, some of my master's students, it's fantastic. I mean, I think it's kept me functioning at a reasonable level because of them. And they have new ideas. They come in. I like multi-generational workplaces. I think they're fantastic. I think we make a mistake when we say a particular industry like IT or AI is only for the young. That's a big mistake. I think we need multi-generational people working because there is something about experience, but there is something about being innovative and being risk-taking. And maybe older generations may not be as risk-taking as maybe younger ones. And the risk-takers come in, they throw an idea, they throw a grenade in, and then you think about, hey, that's interesting. I never thought about that, but you know, that could work. And my experience would tell me that it would work, but only in that kind of way. So I think you're absolutely right. The multi-generational workplaces are exciting and potentially very productive. We have to think about our productivity as a country. We're in real trouble here. We're at 17th in the G20 and 7th in the G7 in terms of productivity per capita. We got to manage people better. We got to think more carefully about and be more innovative and slightly more risk-taking and less conventional. And I think we get that from the young who, if you create the right kind of culture, but you have to create the right kind of culture for the young to be prepared to risk risky ideas.
Yeah. I'm wondering also if the loneliness that's reported might not simply be a reaction to kind of workplace conditions, but actually reflect something in a wider world with the kind of challenges that young people face now compared with my generation. Work can't fix loneliness, I guess. It can, you could do something to kind of mitigate it, I guess, but the problem might be something which is more widespread, more systematic.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, think about this generation. Take the Z generation. Let's go even to the young millennials as well, the one just above them, but not the millennial, full millennials who are nearly 40. Okay, if we look at that generation, the Z generation, the young millennials, number one, they don't have enough money to buy a home or settle in a community. They live in big cities. They are living right up to the hilt. Their connectedness is much less, I mean, partly because of hybrid working, but for a whole variety of other reasons. They live away from their communities they were raised in. You just think about what we did, and look what we did to that generation in the pandemic for a good year and a half. So, you know, I'm not surprised they feel isolated and not involved. And, you know, when I was younger, I mean, I could buy a home in my late 20s easily. They can't do it now. Most of them don't buy a home until their mid-30s if they buy at all. And so, you know, they're not as well connected with society as different generations were. Jobs are more insecure as well. We constrain them as well, young people. We've constrained them with Brexit from engaging with Europe as much as we did when we were in the EU. There's a whole load of things that have happened in their lifetime, the time they've lived in over the last 7 to 10 years, that has made them more socially isolated, in my view.
Thank you very much. Kerry Cooper, Professor of Organisational Psychology and Health at Manchester University's Business School, and also Carmen Smith, Baroness Smith, Applied Cymru Life Peer, who's also the youngest member of the House of Lords. Let's go to check on the latest news headlines a bit late, sorry, with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Rail bosses say there's an epidemic of offending as official figures show a rise in the number of violent crimes and sex offences against women and girls on trains. According to British Transport Police, the number of violent crimes jumped by 5% in the year to the end of March, while the number of sexual offences rose by 10% during the same period. The National Police Chiefs Council has previously described such crimes as a national emergency. Rail bosses are stepping up efforts to combat them. Israel says it will investigate claims from Gaza's health ministry that at least 20 people, including journalists, were killed in strikes on a hospital in the south of the enclave. The Israeli military says it regrets any harm caused and insists it doesn't target reporters. Al Jazeera, Reuters and Associated Press have reported the deaths after the IDF hit the Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis. Israel's security cabinet is expected to discuss a ceasefire deal, which Hamas has already accepted, tomorrow. Tal Schneider from the Times of Israel says Benjamin Netanyahu is facing mounting pressure.
This government is influenced heavily by very extreme ministers. The two ministers that are from the extreme right wing, they keep making threats that they will step out of the government if the government will decide on a ceasefire. So if Netanyahu, if the prime minister wants to go into a ceasefire, he has a majority, but he knows that this is the end of this political government.
One person's been airlifted to hospital after a helicopter crashed on the Isle of Wight. It's thought four people were on board when it came down near Shanklin this morning. According to the operator Northumbria Helicopters, it was being used for a flying lesson. And Keir Starmer's facing pressure to tackle small boat crossings, with protests continuing over the weekend outside asylum hotels. 71% of those surveyed in a poll for The Times believe he's handling the issue badly, despite measures to speed up removals. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for The Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Thanks to a blend of petrol and electric, fill up less this summer with the self-charging Mazda 2 Hybrid Centerline. It's available to finance for £199 per month with 0% APR representative. To go further for less this summer, search Mazda 2 Hybrid. Mazda Financial Services, PCP over 48 months, deposit of 5395, optional final payment of 9833. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. See website.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
You've worked hard to build your business, so it's important it's properly protected. At NFU Mutual, our tradesman insurance has received a 5-star rating by Defaqto for the past 10 years. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. Search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
This is Times Radio.
And this is Richard Cole sitting in for Fee and Jane. You might have noticed the day's getting shorter, the evening's getting ever so slightly colder, and also this time next week, I'm afraid we're going to be in September. As we approach the end of summer, let's delve into the books to watch out for next season with Laura Hackett, the Deputy Literary Editor at The Times and Sunday Times. Autumn preview, Laura. What can we know? A new book from Ian McEwan, hotly anticipated.
Yes, well, I think every novel that Ian McEwan releases ends up being hotly anticipated. Last time it was Lessons back in 2022, which followed, it was a sort of cradle to grave narrative, which followed one man, Roland, kind of through the 20th century. This one's very different. It's set in the year 2119. And by this point, a lot of the UK's lowlands have been submerged by rising sea levels. And it follows an academic called Tom Metcalfe, who is searching in the archives. And he's finding out things about our own time now, and in particular about a sort of lost poem that someone said in 2014, and then it was forgotten. And he's trying to discover things about it. And that's what we know so far. So it's very different from a lot of the things that he's written in the past.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? And I'm wondering what that does to his focus, which is so clear, so sharp, so well defined, to kind of set himself in an imaginary future in this way.
Well, it's interesting because I think, I mean, he's written about so many different things. He's a very versatile writer. Personally, my favourite McEwan novels are the ones that look in the past and that focus on relationships and very particular characters. So Atonement's my all-time favourite, and I love On Chesil Beach as well. But he's done some more complex, almost science-y novels, science fiction in a way as well. So if you remember back to Machines Like Me or The Child in Time, which some people really, really love, and this seems to be a little bit more in that vein. But you're right, he's a very focused writer, but one who can become really interested in a very particular topic and really turn his hand to it. And that seems to be what he's done with What We Can Know.
And much to applaud in a novelist taking on these themes, right? Because he's always been someone who's been fascinated by the really big philosophical, political, moral questions of our time. And he's not shirking it in this book, is he?
Certainly not. No, he definitely throughout his kind of, I think he's written 14 or 15 novels now, and he's never been afraid to take on difficult topics, big ideas, big moral and philosophical ideas, as you say. And I guess this kind of issue of climate fiction is becoming more and more of a thing. Some of it's done really well, some of it not so much. So we're going to have to see what he does with this one.
Do you think it'll be a highlight of the season?
I think it will be up there because he's one of those big names. There are big names that you sort of stand back and watch out when they release a new book. So last year, Alan Hollinghurst had a new one out. So did Sally Rooney. These are names that, you know, regardless of what the novel's like, everyone sort of stands up and pays attention when they've got a new book out.
I mean, I hate to say hotly anticipated again, but it is perhaps overworked, but not in this case. And that is the hotly anticipated memoir of Margaret Atwood.
hotly anticipated for many years. So I was just looking this up. Margaret Atwood's 85 and she's finally got around to writing her memoir. But I mean, who can blame her, because she's been so busy writing such incredible novels. So this comes out on the 4th of November. It's called Book of Lives. And it starts with her childhood, which I didn't know this. She grew up and spent most of her childhood in the wild forests of northern Quebec because her father was an entomologist. And she talks a lot about the kind of isolation that was there and how that's affected her writing. And then from there, we follow her through her life. And she is managing to sort of bring together what was happening in her life and what was happening in her writing life. So The Handmaid's Tale, for instance, she started writing that in 1980s Berlin, so a very divided society. And it's really interesting to then go back to those novels that we know so well and love, and to consider the kind of context in which they were written. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
And of course, some might say that The Handmaid's Tale, it's not something anyone would like to say, but it's prescient as well, that it does anticipate a world, elements of which might be present in our own in our time.
Absolutely. I mean, she's always been a very political writer, and she says that in this memoir there is going to be a lot of political reflections. And she sort of says, you know, a memoir is what you can remember, and a lot of what she has remembered has been catastrophes and upheavals. But in what she's said so far, she's also promised that there will be light relief as well. There will be funny moments and nice heartwarming stories too, so there'll be a bit of a mix of everything.
I love the idea of her imagination being formed in the beetle-rich environment of the forests of Quebec. That's very good, isn't it?
Oh, I know. I think that will be some of the most interesting bits, because I think a writer's childhood is so fascinating. You really see where little moments in the novels that they write are born, little fascinations that are born out of those very particular things that happened to you as a child, and which they might not even realise until they go and look back into their past.
Hotly Anticipated 3. Sorry to go there, but there's nowhere else to go. The latest in the Book of Dust series by Philip Pullman, Volume 3, The Rose Field.
Yes. So this comes out on the 23rd of October. And this is the final part of the entire His Dark Materials story. So there was, first of all, the His Dark Materials trilogy, the first of which came out in 1995, and then the Book of Dust trilogy. And this is the final on that. So, I mean, I'm someone that grew up with the His Dark Materials stories. So for me, this truly is hotly anticipated. But in this book, we follow Lyra, the same character who we've been with from the start. But by now, she's a young woman, and she's been separated from her demon, which, if you haven't read the His Dark Materials books, will sound ridiculous. But this is their sort of, it's like a little animal soulmate that follows them around everywhere. And if you're separated from your demon, it's a really horrendous experience. It feels like you've lost part of your soul. So she goes on this long, dangerous journey to be reunited with her demon. And in the process, we've been promised lots of answers about mysterious things like dust and how the imagination works in that world. So I think for people who've grown up with the series, or perhaps have children who've grown up with the series, this is a really big moment for them.
And also for elderly readers and admirers of Philip Pullman like me, it's going to be anticipate withdrawal symptoms, because I've loved living in this universe from the beginning, and I'm going to be very sorry to leave it.
Yeah, I think what's so magical about it is that although it's obviously, these are children's books, they are very much for adults as well, because they are so deeply serious, really, about the philosophy of that world. A lot of it's based, you know, you can tell from the title, on the writing of John Milton and on his philosophy. So I think whether you're a child reading it because you love the story, or you're an adult reading it because you're interested in the themes and how they work, there's something in it for everyone. So yes, I think lots of people will be, it'll be a bittersweet moment when the final one comes out.
It was an interesting one. I wonder, in a way, all three books are sort of genre busting, or certainly kind of genre expanding, aren't they? I mean, Margaret Atwood explicitly talks about her life's plural rather than her life singular. Philip Pullman, I think, has, I don't think you would shelve those books in the children's section anymore in the bookshop, would you? You'd probably find them in general fiction, where they certainly deserve to be. And Ian McEwan, well, it's very hard to pin anything on him.
No, it's interesting. I think lots of writers this autumn are kind of bursting out of those genres, as you say. Lots of big writers, not just Margaret Atwood, but also Anne Enright and Jeanette Winterson. They're moving away from writing straight novels and they're writing nonfiction instead. So there's a collection of essays coming out by Anne Enright, and Jeanette Winterson has written a sort of take on the story of Aladdin. So it is interesting, as you say, that they're kind of moving beyond what they're known for and they're doing something a little bit different.
Slightly loaded question from me, Laura, but do you think that the kind of golden, long golden summer of cozy crime, that there are sort of signs of autumn encroaching on that?
I'm not sure about that, you know. I mean, we've got the new Richard Osman book, The Impossible Fortune, coming out on September 25th. And, I mean, from my position, we get, you know, maybe hundreds of books sent into us every week. And there are so many in that cozy crime genre. To me, it doesn't look like it's got any sign of slowing. And I also think sometimes the way that we talk about it is a little bit misleading because we act as though it's something brand new. But in fact, if you look back, it's got traces in the writing of Agatha Christie and other sort of golden age of crime novels. You can definitely see where it's got those roots. So I don't think for me that this seems like a fad that's going to pass, but I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I don't know. I wonder if the popularity of cozy crime might have something to do with the general anxiety about the state of the world, because, as you know, there was a great resurgence of interest in that kind of writing in the late 1930s. Anxious worlds produce those kind of books because they offer some sort of reassurance to readers, perhaps.
Absolutely, but I suppose it doesn't look like the world is going to become very much less anxiety evoking very soon, does it? So no. I think for now, the cosy crime renaissance is set to continue.
Hope springs eternal in so very many ways. Laura Hackett, Deputy Literary Editor, The Times and Sunday Times. Thank you very much. 1.3 million students are about to start university. Having got through their exams, and amid all the excitement and nervousness of starting a new life in a new place, there's also the new problem of money. Well, it's an old problem, but in a new way. Key to this is the application for a student loan. What is it? How do you get it? What do we need to know? Our money expert, Adam Shaw, joins me to explain all. Adam, perhaps you could explain in the first place, what is a student loan and do we need them?
Well, most people need them. Universities can charge up to, it's about £9,500 a year in tuition fees. And because they can charge up to that, almost all do. I don't know one that doesn't, unless any listeners know of an exception. You don't pay that yourself, and that's the difference. You get a special student loan from the government. It's really unlike any other loan. There's lots of differences about that. One of which is that you may not have to pay it back. In fact, the government predicts around half, 40-odd percent of students will have their debt wiped out before it's fully paid back. And therefore, it enables you to go to university even if you can't afford to.
It's extraordinary. I'm of the generation who got a fantastic education, well, for nothing apart from what, you know, contributed in tax, I suppose. And it seems extraordinary to me that I talk to students now who are coming out with 40, 50, maybe £60,000 of debt. And yet they do seem to take that on the chin. And is that because there's something about the student loan which is perhaps different from other kind of loans? Well, not least the chance of not having to pay it back.
Yes, I think that there's two really important things embedded in that question. One is a societal view of debt and how that's changed and how that might affect individuals. And secondly, the purpose of the student loan, the political purpose. And I think regardless of what you think the effect of that has been, there was good motivation behind it in that it's felt, look, graduates earn more money. As a rule, there's a graduate premium is the thought. Let alone the money, we quite like the UK population to be better educated, to be more informed, more involved in the world. And going through university is supposedly part of that process. So the student loan system was meant to be there to enable an expansion of the numbers of people going to university, rather than in the old system that you went in under and I went in under, where you paid nothing. In fact, you not only paid nothing, what you didn't mention was the fact they paid you. They gave you money for your beer and your books and all the rest of it. So that's what it is meant to do. I think the flip side of that is that debt was seen as a bad thing, perhaps when I went to university, but certainly before that. I mean, if you look further back into the 60s and 70s, it was definitely seen as a moral issue. And society has changed since then. And I think one of the things we don't often talk about, perhaps on a bigger scale, is the fact that debt is just part of the process now. So if you've got 50,000 quid's worth of student debt, you think, well, what on earth? Why should I bother not ranking up another thousand couple of quid on my credit card?
Yeah.
So I think that's in answer to that. But one has to be really clear. Student debt is not like credit card debt. It's much easier.
Well, because you might have to rack up more debt because the cost of living, of course, is rising. You mentioned maintenance grants. As in my day, we were given money, as you say, for beer and books. How about living expenses? How can students look to cover those?
So as well as the student loan, you get a maintenance loan. It's a little more complex than maintenance loan because it's partly means tested. So how much you get is based on what your, in most cases, what your parents earn. It depends on where you're living. It depends on if you're studying or living in London. It ranges, a vast range in the maintenance loan, from a little under £4,000 to around about £13,500. And it's different if you live in England, Northern Ireland, Scotland. There are very different rules apply. But you pay, there's lots of different schemes, but to be simple about it, you start paying interest of around about 4% at the moment from the moment you take that loan out. You don't start paying it back until you've hit a certain amount of money on your salary. But the debt is building up all the time.
What about, you mentioned the means test, if parents who are required under that arrangement to contribute to their child's maintenance, what happens if they don't want to do it? What can people do?
Yes, I mean, that is clearly a huge issue for, I suppose, what might be a limited number of people, but for those people, it's a big issue. Your parents are expected to contribute to your maintenance loan if they can afford to. It may be that they just refuse to, or it may be that you're estranged from your parents and have a very difficult relationship. If that is the case, you can be assessed under your own income, which, to be honest, is probably zero. It is what you are termed as being estranged. That's the term you should Google or Bing or your search engine of choice, estranged from my parents. And there are specific ways of applying for that so that, OK, you go, my parents aren't going to help me out. I need help from the government. And there are well-managed schemes to sort that out. And I've put it on my social medias. But if you just Google estranged from my parents, how do I get government support? And that's the way you can get that.
So there are ways of fixing that if need be.
Indeed.
What's the interest charged on a student loan?
Well, it varies. And in typical ways, the government doesn't make anything easy, does it? There's a sort of RPI and inflation plus amount, and it depends on what schemes you're going under. But it's around about 4%. And then what happens is that you pay, so your interest is 4%, but you pay 9% of your salary once your salary hits over £25,000. So there's lots of numbers there, but as a worked example, if you're earning 30 grand a year, you pay 9% of the difference between 25 and 30 grand. That's 450 quid a year. So that's what the cost of paying back your loan is, that 450 quid a year. And after 40 years, which is a long time, you're just about to go to university, it makes it sound like an eon. But after 40 years, whether or not you have paid the debt, the whole debt is written off.
We've talked about how loans has perhaps affected our perception of debt. Do you think there's also, it's affected our perception of education? I thought when I went into tertiary education, not having to pay in this way for it, it felt like a kind of free-range experience. You could go where you wanted. My sense now is that many young people going into tertiary education have a much more transactional sense of it, that because they're paying, they expect to get credits at the end of that, which will, you know, turn in the future into, well, not least a means of paying back the loan they've taken out.
I think that's absolutely true. You're paying for a service. You're paying a lot of money for a service. And I think especially since COVID, a lot of the younger people I've spoken to at universities around the UK don't feel they're getting value for money. That started during COVID, I think, especially when there was understandably much less connection. But I've seen it progress after COVID. And I've been shocked, actually, personally shocked, by the little amount of contact time students get compared to when I was at university. You talk about cost. Again, I was having a look at the cost of British universities compared to around the world. And what shocked me is that according to the OECD is doing some really good numbers on this. We are the most expensive. Now, I thought it would be America, but America is only the most expensive. If you look at private universities, their state universities are much, much cheaper than us. And we are hugely ahead of anybody else, certainly in Europe, but even in places like Japan, Canada. And I think there's a sort of odd question about, I know universities complain that they don't have the finances really to maintain stability. It's a bit of a mystery to me because the figures seem to suggest they are the most expensive. And I think lots of students aren't happy with the service they receive.
There was perhaps a bit of a casino culture that prevailed when the 9,000 fee limit was fixed, as I recall. And I wonder just how stable that sector is now. There have been reports, haven't there, about in a less generous funding era, some universities might not be able to survive. They're shedding courses. They might have to merge. Do you think that's something that students should be taking into consideration when they think about their next step?
No, I think, over the next 3 years or 4 years, if you're in a Scottish university, really, I don't think we're going to see the collapse of universities. And I think, what you want to worry about is sorting out your life. It's an exciting, if probably a little worrisome, time for you. You've got to find accommodation. You've got to work out the course you're on. You've got to sort out the budget, probably for the first time. I think the structure of the system isn't something you should be worried about. It is something that the likes of you and me should be worried about. We're past the age of going to university, probably. Most people won't have gone back at our age, although you can, of course. And therefore, I think asking the question of the value of universities and whether they actually are the things that we want to provide, that you have to go to university now to get jobs that you never needed a degree for in the past. So I think there is an interesting question here, that there's sort of been a qualification demand inflation, that jobs that didn't need a degree now need a degree. So what was the purpose of going to university? Because in the past, you could have just left school and got experience. And I think there are genuine structural questions to be asked about whether actually experience and on-the-job training might be better for many people than an academic course.
Adam Shaw, thank you very much. Adam's written a quick guide to student finance for the programme. You can find it on www.themoneydoctor.tv. And apologies for speaking as if I was only referring to English universities. Of course, different situations prevail in Scotland. It is now, it's coming up to 4 o'clock, and I'm Richard Coles, and I'm sitting in for Jane and Fee.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide. A good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgette? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
You've reached the final level. The Spicy McNuggets side mission. Maximum flavour, crispy crunch and a spicy dip with a kick.
Are you ready?
Spicy McNuggets, for a limited time only.
Until the 9th of September 25. Fees apply to delivery. Participation and price may vary. Subject to availability. Serving times apply.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
This is Times Radio.
Well, that's it from me today. Jane and Fee will be back tomorrow from 2. It's been great to have your company. Thank you. Our producer today was Rosie Cutler. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Richard. See you again soon, I hope. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pina, and this is Times Radio Drive on this bank holiday Monday, and here are the headlines. Official figures show there's been a rise in the number of violent crimes and sex offences against women and girls on trains, with rail bosses calling it an epidemic. And Israel says it'll investigate claims at least 20 people, including journalists, have been killed in a strike on a hospital in Gaza. You can hear my interview later with a doctor from the hospital. And coming up, that interview with the doctor at Nasser Hospital. We're going to be looking at the government's plans to overhaul the asylum appeals process and look at that poll for the Times showing 71% of voters think the PM is handling the issue of asylum badly.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Rail bosses say there's an epidemic of offending as official figures show a rise in the number of violent crimes and sex offences against women and girls on trains. According to British Transport Police, the number of violent crimes jumped by 5% in the year to the end of March, while the number of sexual offences rose by 10% during the same period. The National Police Chiefs Council has previously described such crimes as a national emergency. Five journalists are among 20 people killed in an Israeli strike on a hospital in Gaza. The IDF says it's investigating the attack on the Nasser hospital and insists it does not target journalists. Al Jazeera has confirmed one of its staff, Mohamed Salama, has died. Mohamed Mawawa, the managing editor of the broadcaster, says those working in the area will continue to report on what's happening.
We are very committed to continuing the coverage. All of them say that this is our story, those are our people, and we are here committed to this profession, to this journalism, and we want to make sure that the story is out to the world.
Sir Keir Starmer is facing calls to take a more radical approach to the small boats crisis, with mounting public concern about the government's handling of the issue. A YouGov poll for The Times today says 7 out of 10 voters think he has handled the asylum hotel issue badly. In a move aimed at addressing the problem, Home Secretary Yvette Cooper has announced plans to speed up asylum appeals and deportations. Stephen Swinford, The Times' political editor, says the Prime Minister is under huge pressure.
Talking to ministers and backbenchers yesterday, some of whom were on holiday, they're really worried about it. And their worry, Joe, is particularly this, that the government's response to this, they said that while a lot of the individual measures are commendable, it's not enough. We are on the beaches today in France. We've got reporters down on there, and we're hearing reports of hundreds of people making crossings today again. So you can see that kind of entering the headlines again tomorrow. And it's just going to go on. And the pressure will build and build because the government doesn't appear to have, or clearly doesn't have, in fact, a viable deterrent to deal with this issue.
A man wrongfully deported by US officials has been taken into custody after returning to America. Kilmar Abredo Garcia was sent to a notorious prison in his native El Salvador in March and then brought back to face human smuggling charges. His lawyers say he could be deported to Uganda or Costa Rica following his refusal to accept a plea deal. Almost 800 shoplifting offences are going unsolved every day. That's according to latest figures from the House of Commons Library. The Met Police has the worst record, with only 5.9% of cases resulting in a charge in 2024 to 2025. Former Scotland Yard Detective Mike Neville says technology could be used more effectively.
In the police, there's an obsession with this live facial recognition, which is all very good and useful at Notting Hill Carnival. They could solve thousands more crimes if they used it effectively in these situations.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, the airstrikes on a hospital in Gaza were not unprecedented, but when the news came in, it was no less horrifying for that. Here it is, breaking on the US broadcaster CBC.
There is breaking news out of the Gaza Strip this morning. A pair of Israeli strikes have hit a hospital in Khan Yunis, and at least 15 people have been killed, including 4 journalists.
Well, at Times Radio this morning, scant details about the victims were trickling through.
Health officials in Gaza say Israeli strikes on Nasser Hospital in the south of the Strip have killed at least 15 people, including three journalists, one of whom works for Reuters. There's no comment as yet from the IDF.
Now, the latest reports say at least 20 people were killed, including as many as five journalists. The Israeli military says it's examining the incident and does not target innocents deliberately. We'll tell that, though, to the doctor that I spoke to just ahead of the show. Dr. Saba Al-Azma was at Nasser Hospital when the first strike hit, and then the second.
I can tell the horror and the fear in the eyes of my patients and also in the medical staff. We started to run. Actually, we didn't go. We didn't know where to go, actually, because it's all become darker and people are screaming everywhere.
Dr. Saba told me of the serious struggles they face at that hospital treating patients.
We are now trying to use the same gauze for different patients now because we don't have enough gauzes. The same thing happening with painkillers. We can't find enough painkillers for the patients. And, you know, most of our patients are from the casualties and severe injuries that need painkillers. We have been seeing injuries like we have never seen before.
Well, you can hear my full conversation with an understandably emotional Dr. Al-Azma in the next hour of the programme. Here, a lot of people feel, 7 out of 10 people, according to a new poll, that the government is handling the issue of asylum seekers badly. Now, that's hardly surprising. The news is full of angry locals, interspersed with hardliners from outside and egged on by opposition party politicians, protesting outside hotels, housing asylum seekers waiting to have their claims processed. The poll, though, doesn't address the obvious next question. It's more difficult. What would you do better? Well, Nigel Farage's Reform Party doesn't believe the answer is difficult at all. He wants to strip those who aren't British of human rights protection, to arrest Channel boat migrants when they step off their boats and deport or send them to their countries of origin, whether or not they might be tortured or killed when they get there. Now, you decide if that is what you want as British policy. We're going to be looking at that and whether it is practicable, humane and legally sound tomorrow. Today, though, we can look at the government's plan to speed up the processing of asylum claims, starting with those in the hotels and using a new body of adjudicators to take the load off our overstretched asylum tribunal judges. Will any of this do anything to end the protests and disarm the issue as a big government headache? And while we're at it, let's find out why so many asylum claims succeed. About half at the first time of asking and half on appeal. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word times. Now, pressure mounting then on the government to deal with migrations, created a new independent body to deal with asylum appeals made up of these independent adjudicators. We can talk to Danny Shaw, crime correspondent. Welcome to you, Danny.